nails that tightly bind us together. We just pull them out one by one. We're not even sure why. And the wedges knock them away. Well, why do Yunmen sometimes open the door and set out a bowl of glue? Or dig a pitfall in the middle of the road? And the words like, kind of set up a trap. Open the door with a bowl of glue in front for us to walk into. Then the story goes like this. A monk asked Yunmen, when not producing a single thought, is there any fault or not? Yunmen said, Mount Sumeru. That's today's story.
Didn't hear what Yunmen said.
Mount Sumeru. When not producing a single thought, is there any fault or not? Just to, you might have some ideas about this, just hearing this story, or you might not have any ideas about this. But here's some ideas that that are said to be not what this is about. One of the ancients commenting on this story said, this story is debated everywhere in old China. Some people say that as soon as one questions in this way, already this is raising a thought, a fault as big as Mount Sumeru, the huge mountain. So, when not producing a single thought, is there any fault or not? Well, that sounds like producing a thought, right? To ask the question, is there any fault? And this asking the question is like a huge fault. For a non-thinking mind, right? A fault as big as the great Mount Sumeru. But that's not what it's about. Some say that Yunmen's answer is like celebrating this not producing a single thought, being like Mount Sumeru, unmoved by the eight winds, remaining steadfast for 1,000 ages. But that's not what it's about. Some say that because it's difficult for people to pass through and understand when not producing a single thought, is there any fault or not? This is so difficult an issue that it's like this towering mountain blocking our path. But that's not what it's about. Such assessments have not yet comprehended Yunmen's meaning. Only if the bottom of the bucket has fallen out will you realize it is not so at all. It's not like any of these answers. The bottom of the bucket falling out is one of those Zen expressions. I think wonderful expression. We're carrying our load around through our life, all our stuff, and just release it. Let it all dump out. Like if you've been looking around for a toilet for hours and you finally find one and sit down, let the bottom drop out. Great release. So first we can look at this question. This monk asks this question. When not producing a single thought, is there any fault or not? I would propose that Zen practice is all about our relationship to thought and thinking. We could put it this way. We could even say, well, like the Buddha said, I only teach two things, suffering and the end of suffering. The whole path is just to help us find some freedom and ease. You could say, well, that doesn't sound like it's just a bad thought. But if we examine our suffering, our discontent in this life, does it not seem that, I don't know, 95% of our suffering is due to thought? I mean, speaking for myself, it seems like it's the case for me. The other 5% might be like, I have a really bad headache, and it's just really painful. Some, you know, physical pain. For some people, that might be their dominant suffering, dis-ease. But even with the case of a headache, we might even be able to propose that actually the headache itself is not so much the problem as the thought, when will this headache go away? We also might say emotions. You know, we might say, well, thoughts aren't so much the problem, but it's more like emotions of anger, greed, jealousy, envy, confusion, all kinds of blends of different emotions surely cause a lot of suffering. But again, speaking for myself anyway, if I stay with those emotions for a while and examine where they're coming from, almost always there's some thought behind it. There's a thought. Not always, but very commonly. So this issue of thinking is no small matter for us. We need to use thinking all the time. We can't eliminate thinking. It's how we function in this world. That's a lot of our function in this world, is thinking. And the activities and communications and so on that arise from our thinking. But then we can see how in Zazen, it may be that our thinking just continues on incessantly. It's often like that in Zazen too, right? Maybe it settles down a little bit. It's a lower level of thinking, so it's somewhat relief. And sometimes we can really open the hand of thought. We can really let go for a moment or two of our incessantly thinking mind and just rest in the breath flowing in and out in the body, sitting. And it's a completely different world. It often feels like it's a whole different world when we're not like engaging the thought machine. Isn't it? I mean, I think that's, you might not put it exactly this way, but I think something like this is a lot of the reason why we come to Zazen again and again. It's a relief, if only temporarily. Dogen says in his King of Samadhi's essay, he says, "Know that the world of Zazen is far different from other worlds, like the world of incessant thinking." Sometimes we like to emphasize that the world of Zazen is actually not really different. It's just another part of our life. But in another sense, we could say also that Zazen is like a different world. And sometimes the contrast is just so refreshing. And it's such a reminder. It puts things in perspective. We're really caught up in some problem, based on thinking. And then we come to sit and just let go of it for a little bit. And then it's like, even though we know we might have to, we come back to this, to the issue or something after Zazen, it's like we have a new perspective. You sometimes feel that way? It's like, well, I have to deal with this, but now I know that actually, without anything different, without any, like, you know, manipulating the physical world or something like that, when I was just sitting there without thinking about this issue, there was actually no problem at that time. And so I think that's a big perspective shifter. We can see that it's possible to be that way. Now we think, well, now it's not possible anymore. Now I have to pick it up and deal with this involving a lot of thinking. But we know now that there's another way of being. So, and we also know that we can't live this life without thinking at all. That's impossible. That would be like being a vegetable. Even in Zazen, a lot of our Zazen is not comprised of just no thought. Thinking is going on. So again, it's what's our relationship to thought and thinking in Zazen and in daily life. So we could say, we could take this very literally, this monk's question, we're not producing a single thought. Like, if no thought arises, there's just pure thoughtless awareness. Is there any fault or not? But in the Zen tradition, our relationship to thinking can be more subtle than just no thought at all. For example, in the Platform Sutra of the Sixth Ancestor of Zen, there's it's one of the very early Zen teachings. He gives a great teaching, I think, about a summary of Zen practice, really. Huineng, the sixth ancestor, says, "Good friends, in this teaching of ours, this Zen tradition, from ancient times up to the present, everyone has set up no thought as the main teaching, no form as the essence, and non-abiding as the basis." From the beginning, all the Zen ancestors have set up or proclaimed non-thought as the main teaching, non-form as the essence, and non-abiding as the basis. And then he's going to define these. Non-form is to be free from form even when associated with form. So it doesn't mean like we have to like set off a nuclear bomb and obliterate all material matter or something like this, right? It's non-form means to be free from form even when associated with form or when relating to form. This is a beautiful expression of the middle way. So we're relating to form at the same time that there's really no form. To be free from form even when associated with form. Similarly, non-thought is not to think even when involved in thought. That's a great Zazen instruction, I think. It's not about eliminate all your thought, but it's to not think even when you're involved in thought. How is that possible? It's kind of like what this monk's question is. Non-abiding is the original nature of all people, the sixth ancestor says. Non-thought is not to think, even when involved in thought. So when practicing this non-thinking, that's not eliminating all thought and not grasping any thought at the same time. We're not producing a single thought. Is there any fault or not? We could also, maybe we could also turn this a little bit, contemplate the words of this question too. We're not producing, giving rise to a thought. Is there any fault or not? So we could say, thoughts are arising or ceasing, but when I don't produce them or create them, they're just arising. At that time, is there any fault or not? It's more like we're letting them come and go, but we're not producing them. I'm not producing them. Let's see, I have this issue. I really have to think about this and figure it out. It's like not doing that. Just this issue, it arises in my zazen, but I'm not going to solve it, actually. We could say is zazen. I'm not going to produce some extra thoughts on top of this thought that's arising. At such a time, is there any fault or not? We could say from the biggest perspective of awakening itself, we could say, is there anything missing there? Is this awakening? Or is there any problem or fault or missing piece of Buddha's mind when not producing a single thought? So it is, it's a beautiful question, I think, because it's an investigation of what is the great matter here, actually. How to practice zazen, how to actually really be free in this life from this turmoil of suffering arising from a thought. Is this the whole practice? I feel like this monk's very sincere. Is there any fault here or not? Am I missing anything? And Yunmen says, Mount Sumeru. This is this mountain in Indian Buddhist cosmology that's like the center of the universe. The great, huge mountain. 80,000 yojanas high. I looked it up a little bit to kind of like warm up to Mount Sumeru, kind of get into it. Abhidharma Kosha, you know, has a great description of the structure of the universe that doesn't exactly accord with like modern geography and science, but it's interesting to see how the old Indians thought before they anyone traveled outside of India, for example, what they thought the world was, or even really the whole universe. They proposed that first there's just space. Maybe that accords with modern science. First there's empty, vast space with no boundaries. And then doesn't say exactly how it happens, but from the space element, air or wind arises. I say it doesn't say exactly how it happens, kind of like physically, but I was surprised to see, I hadn't read this before in this Abhidharma Kosha text, that it said these elements that are gradually formed like this are created by the actions of sentient beings. I thought that was like the coolest thing to hear. You mean wind is created by the minds and the body and speech that comes from the mind of sentient beings. That's the proposal in this old text. It's almost like, by the way, it's like describing the structure of wind and these elements. And the basic cause of this is the karma or activities of sentient beings. Wow. In Tibetan Vajrayana Buddhism, there's a lot of visualization practice, and the kind of standard visualization of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and these beings that are you, yourself. You start with, I think quite beautifully, you start with visualizing the creation of the universe. It's like you're going through the Big Bang, we might say, in your visualization. So you're starting from just empty space, nothing's happening. And then you create. And I think if you get really used to this, you're doing it a lot, you really maybe start experiencing the Big Bang. Or your own birth, actually, too. So there's the wind element forms. And then kind of on this circle of wind, and then on top of the circle of wind is a circle of water. This is how the old Indians put it. On top of the water, the top of the water starts churning around the waves like butter. So it starts solidifying like butter, and that becomes the earth. And then on top of the earth, then fire, actually wasn't mentioned in the Abhidharma Kosha, but you could say the fire element is the heat, creating the universe, part of the universe here. And then on top of the earth is Mount Sumeru. So these gradually piled elements, and then the mountain at the top. And in these visualizations, then there's the celestial palace on top of the mountain, and you are sitting in the center of that, surrounded by all kinds of celestial beings. But here in this, in the classic Abhidharma description, Mount Sumeru is these 80 yojanas high, yojanas like not 80,000 yojanas high, and a yojana is like 9 miles. So it's like much larger than planet Earth. It's maybe close to the size of the sun, technically, this size of Mount Sumeru. And it also extends below the Earth, 80,000 yojanas. And it's built like, it has these layers where different beings reside. And in Japan, they call Sumeru Shumi. And the altar in Zen temples is the Shumidan, or the Sumeru altar. And it's built, like our altar here is built in the same structure that the Abhidharma describes of these, it starts out wide at the bottom, and then it goes up a step like that. And on each step, there's different types of devas and beings. And then it gets kind of narrow in the middle, and then the steps are going out again. Just like this altar, this Shumidan. And then the top is the palace, and here we have Shakyamuni Buddha and Manjushri Bodhisattva on top of Mount Sumeru. We can think of this story when we're bowing to this altar. It's the center of the universe. It's the Axis Mundi, which I think maybe almost every religious tradition has some form of this Axis Mundi. Is like that. Mundi is like the world, and the axis is like the center line. And there's many stories in all different mythologies about this center that kind of like the axis that connects heaven and earth. And in the Buddhist version, it's like that too. Below Mount Sumeru are all the hell realms, and above Mount Sumeru in the sky are all these heaven realms. And in the center is this huge mountain. So this is just all Indian cosmology that the Zen people just knew about. They didn't really get into all these details, but they it was part of the archetypes of their world. And but basically it represents, like, we could say the very center, it's the connection between heaven and earth, or the connection between form and emptiness. This mountain is like indestructible and boundless. As a commentary to this koan says, Mount Sumeru cannot be covered by the sky. Earth cannot support it. Wind blowing cannot enter it. Water poured on it cannot wet it. It's surrounded by all these elements, but it's immovable as they surround it. Only the Vajra eye can see through it at a glance, whereupon one sees seven openings. This is an interesting kind of Zen. Strange imagery here, right? This impenetrable mountain that can't be touched by any of the elements, but the Vajra eye, like the wisdom eye of Buddha, can see through this mountain at a glance, whereupon one sees seven openings and straight away finds that it's shattered to smithereens. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven. Right in the face of Mount Sumeru, one can enter, and it's shattered to smithereens. Then after that, it's on the eyebrows and eyelashes, solitary and beyond transcendence, lofty, steep, and magnificent. So, this great mountain that's the center of the universe seems impenetrable, trouble, but when we look more closely, it has these openings that where we enter it, and then it rests on our eyebrows and eyelashes. Mount Sumeru. Those Zen ancestors, what are you going to do about them? Talking that way. I remember one time, many years ago, for some reason, this stayed with me. I heard many, many Dharma talks about these Zen stories, but I remember one time, Zoketsu Fisher Roshi once brought up this story, and he started doing like a guided meditation. Like, this is my memory of it. Like, you know, sit, find your comfortable seat. However you're sitting, just relax, settle onto your seat, upright and stable, solid and immovable, mountain-like form. The winds blowing through the window can't shake us off our seat. And now we can start feeling some trees sprouting on our knees, some flowers popping up, tiny, tiny little trees now all over our legs, and there's deer walking around on our lap, and there's rivers flowing down our belly, and as we go, move up to the shoulders, now we're like above the tree line, and it's all rocky crags and only some birds flying around our nose, and our top of our head is reaching into the sky with clouds dancing around our head. We're not producing a single thought. Is there any fault or not? Mount Sumeru. The the commentary says also, in actuality, this thing is always obvious, out in the open, like a black mountain high and steep. Who can cover it? Before it's imparted, do you really have no share? Imparted to you, is it newly gained? In other words, we might not have felt to be so stable, and especially like letting deer graze about on our knees and birds fly around our head. But the commentator says, before this direct experience of being Mount Sumeru is imparted, do you really have no share of it? I mean, you can't really make yourself into Mount Sumeru, right? And imparted to you, when Mount Sumeru is transmitted, you are the great center of the universe. Is it something newly gained? The commentator asks. How could it be? The mountain has never moved for all time, the commentator says, and the clouds appearing and disappearing are always peaceful. And then he quotes Dungshan, who said, the green mountain is the father of the white clouds. The white clouds are the children of the green mountain. The white clouds hang around all day, and the green mountain doesn't mind at all. So sometimes that this metaphor is used for Zazen is like the mind, it's like the open sky or the vast ocean or a great mountain, and the clouds are the thoughts that come and go. But they don't disturb this mountain or this sky or this ocean. They're just like dancing with it. So that's also related to when not producing a single thought, is there any fault or not? Could it be that not producing a single thought is a lot of cloud-like thoughts dancing around Mount Sumeru? But if we're truly being Mount Sumeru, the clouds don't bother the mountain whatsoever. Even if they completely enshroud the mountain, sometimes at the tops of those mountains, right, there's thick fog. You can't see anywhere because you're inside a cloud. But they don't shake the mountain at all. This is how I understand the six ancestors. Non-thinking is not to think even when involved in thought. Any questions or comments? How to practice with this story? Yes.
Well, I appreciate you describing Mount Sumeru because I've never really known that much about it. But I still don't understand how his answer connects to the monk's question and how that relates to me. Unless I get super, super metaphorical and really out there, like, which is maybe that's the point. But I'm just curious about
Especially since I think one of the hardest parts is right at the beginning of this long commentary, he says, these are ways that people commonly look at it.
Right? Yeah, I thought they all sounded pretty good.
Yeah, they did, didn't they? I thought so too. So it's nice that he covered that at the beginning. The nice answers. But then remember what he said?
No.
These assessments have not comprehended Yun Men's meaning only if the bottom of the bucket has fallen out and the red thread is broken off, will you realize it's not so at all. The red thread is like the lifeline. It's the same thing as dropping the bottom of the bucket. Which is very similar to this, to what's going on with this question, right? We're talking about thought here. When not producing a single thought, is there any fault or not? And is there a way to like ask such a question, you know, to ourselves even, in a way that doesn't give rise to more thoughts, that doesn't produce a thought, or even like when the answer comes to my question, how can I not produce another thought?
Well, so he's saying not sooner.
Yes.
So what's your take on that?
Well,
what's the connection between that and this big, huge, vast center of the universe cosmological aspect?
Do you want me to produce a thought for you to think about?
Yes. Because this is a question and answer period.
Yeah. Yeah. It is allowed. Yeah, so it's interesting, this Zen realm that's like trying, you know, all these stories are very strange, right? They're never, like the Abhidharma Kosha is very different, right? It's like, do you want to know the structure of the universe? It's going to take about 20 pages, but we'll give it to you. 80,000 yojanas high, 80,000 deep, 80,000 wide, and the center is 20,000, and so on. And the color, the different faces have these different colors, and the four continents are arranged. And then we're, oh yes, I got it. I've even drawn pictures of it myself to make sure that I know it, what it looks like. But this is something different, right? We're not producing it, a single thought. Is there any fault or not? And, this is, I hope I'm answering the question with all this. But I looked at Tenzin Roshi's commentary to this story, and his very first thing he said, which before he got into all kinds of other weirdness, was sometimes it seems like the order of these stories is seems like it's very methodical, like Wansong, the commentator, really chose the order of koans carefully, and sometimes he said, I can't see what, it seems kind of random, but he said, it's worth reflecting on this story, the particular order that it follows, case number 18, which we talked about some months ago. Case 18 was Zhaozhou's dog. Some of you might have been around for this story, and this particular version of Zhaozhou's dog, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? Zhaozhou says, yes. And the monk says, well, but I thought, then why is it, you know, in this dog body? And so on. And then later another monk asks Zhaozhou, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? And he says, no. And the monk says, well, I thought all beings have Buddha nature. Why isn't the dog? And, you know, and so on. But it's this story about like yes and no. Does a dog have Buddha nature or not? A yes, and then a no, and then here's some explanations. This story, when not producing a single thought, is there any fault or not? A similar kind of setup. So the question is very similar. Does a dog have Buddha nature or not? In this case, when not producing a thought, is there any fault or not? Is it this way or is it this way? And so in this case, it's a very short story. Just Mount Sumeru, which is like this towering mountain is not engaged in the realm of yes and no and faults and no faults. We can even hear it as we can hear it as confirmation of this monk's question, like, or together, they're in a dialogue together, right? Together, here is Mount Sumeru, or we can hear it as, you might be getting a little off track with this question, so I'd like to offer you some Zazen instruction, Mount Sumeru.
It's like just sitting, in a way. I mean,
Mount Sumeru does just sit. Yeah, and doesn't move, and isn't bothered by the white clouds, and doesn't think of itself as like the center of the universe, of around which the sun and moon revolve and the continents are laid out. And following the Abhidharma Kosha, you know, even though it's not exactly a Zen text, I think it's quite interesting that what's the primary cause for each of the elements and Mount Sumeru? The actions of sentient beings. The activities of the mind is where Mount Sumeru arises from, even though it's never begun and never ends, and it's immovable, and it's immovable and can't be penetrated, but yet, looking closer, it has these seven openings, and as we enter, then it. Now it's this huge mountain bigger than the sun is like resting on our eyebrows and eyelashes. Dogen once said, talking about miracles, Dogen wrote an essay on miracles, and he said, he's talking about the great miracle of Zazen, but he also talks about like minor miracles. I think Patrick brought this up in the last year, this essay of Dogen. One of the minor miracles is that a mustard seed contains Mount Sumeru. Mm-hmm. And then when Dogen goes on to say, a mustard seed breathes out Mount Sumeru and actualizes the inexhaustible phenomenal world. When a tuft of hair or a mustard seed breathes out a great ocean, breathing out happens in one moment, and it happens in myriad eons. So that clarifies it. Yes, Stan.
What's been fascinating, and really thank you for your insights, as Kathy was saying, in terms of Mount Sumeru and putting it all together with the five elements, the traditional Tibetan five elements in China and in India. But I'm wondering, what I'm fascinated with now is just learning that the universe is 70% dark energy, 28% dark matter, 8%
only 2% stuff.
And maybe in terms of bringing the two together,
that's
Mount Sumeru is that big 98% that you can't perceive, out of which
Well, it's interesting. Yeah. It may be time to write the sequel to the Abhidharma Kosha.
Yeah.
a new version of the structure of the universe. And that would be interesting whether we'd say Mount Sumeru is the 98% or the 2% of stuff.
Bingo.
You know, it was very stuff-like in the original story. And then, you know, space is the basis. And it's interesting that I noticed, whether it was random or not, that this Abhidharma Kosha didn't say that space was created by human karma. It just started with wind is. Like there's just in the beginning there's just space because it's not stuff. Maybe space is the dark matter, and then the elements arise from mind. Yeah, and we call them stuff, but you know, strictly speaking, that, you know, from a Dharma point of view, even the 2% is not really stuff. Yes, Richard.
My mom used to say when at the dinner table, if I was complaining about not performing well, or she would just say, "Have confidence, Richie." And I would say, "I don't understand what you're talking about, Mom. That doesn't work that way." And in a sense, that's kind of how I feel about what we're talking about now. To say, be effortlessly, be Wu Wei. Do things without you producing thought. And I think, and my response is, what about all that nail pulling? And what is that nail pulling? And all that work that has to go into the groundwork before I can really practice effortless effort and Wu Wei. And I want instruction about or I want to talk about those, that nail pulling. You know,
yeah. Well, we could say that I think according to this, you know, this story, he's saying Yun Men always likes to pull out the nails. So he's saying Mount Sumeru is just one big nail pull. But we could also say that in this image of the deer grazing on our knees and the trees growing up and the spring wildflowers on our toes, it's maybe like, between two toes, down at the base of the mountain here, there's a little wood shop. And in this spring morning, there's a little, carpenter. And he's in the wood shop there. Somebody just dropped off a truckload of pile wood with all these little nails in it. And he's down there between two toes at the foot of Mount Sumeru pulling nails all day long out of these piles of wood. So there's that too. Yeah. Mount Sumeru is one big nail pull, and all the beings on Mount Sumeru are going about their day with a hammer and a crowbar, pulling out little nails one at a time. And it's all one big harmonious thing. While they're doing that work, they're on Mount Sumeru. Right? They're doing that work between two toes in the foothills of Mount Sumeru.
Those two toes, is there a lot of self-examining going on?
Yeah.
Part of nail pulling.
And self-examining involves thought, and so there's some thinking going on, but when not a single thought is produced, even in the midst of thought, is there any fault or not? And also your story about your dad, did you say?
Mom.
Saying, you have some doubt, but she says, just be confident. In a way, that's this monk's question. Like, I think this is a question we all have, a question I have a lot. I'm a doubting type. So, when I'm practicing this way, is there any fault or not? That's a big thing that we're asking. So if we tend to be like the self-critical or self-doubting types, then this story's for us. Is there any fault or not? We could even forget the we're not producing a single thought part and just say, all day long we start feeling like earlier today I like was trying to send somebody a bunch of email addresses and I so the way that I usually get them is like I put them in the send part, right? And then you get the email and you copy it and paste it into the text of the thing, and then you go back and you erase the ones to send those names and send it to one person. So I did that and I sent it, and then I realized I forgot to erase all the emails. I don't know if you can follow. This is like a modern technology problem. And I felt like, oh no, that's so messy. Like now everybody like who I sent it to gets to see my little communication to this other person. And I thought, oh, that's so stupid. I can't believe I did that. Major fault. And then like, so how do I now live with that? Email is great because like as soon as you press a button, it's no return. The same with mailing a letter, but you have the time when you go walk into the post office before, oh no, I forgot to put something else in the envelope, whatever. Is there any fault or not, right? Meanwhile, the computer is between two toes, Mount Sumeru. So I just finish with the verse that celebrates this story by Tien Tung Hongzhi. Not producing a single thought, Mount Sumeru. Yunmen's gift, Dharma gift is not stingy in intent. If you come with acceptance, he imparts with both hands. If you, just gratefully receive Yunmen's Sumeru, he imparts it with both hands. If you go on doubting, it's so high you can't get a hold. The blue ocean is wide. The white clouds are peaceful around the mountain. Don't put so much as a tip of a hair in there. A phony rooster crow can hardly fool a person. I still won't agree to let you pass through the gate in confusion. And again, the blue ocean around all directions, endlessly around Mount Sumeru, is wide. And the comment on that line is, flooding the heavens and bathing the sun, it has no shore, this vast ocean. The white clouds are peaceful. The thoughts dancing around the mountain. The comment is, following the wind along with the waves, they're free. When the clouds follow the wind and the choppy waves that come and go on the surface of this vast ocean, without grasping or resisting, the clouds are free. May the Dharma of the Zen ancestors pull out all nails and knock out all wedges for being after being, time after time, all around the hills and vales of Mount Sumeru. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. The illusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. And Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.